The sun's rising over America. Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Let's get rolling. Call 866-680-6464. Atlantic to Pacific, north to south, across the globe. It's Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Here's your guest host, Seth Liebson.
Good morning. It is March 9th, 2012. Seth Liebson in for Bill today. Privileged to be, as I am most Fridays, from Phoenix, Arizona at the Patriot, 960 AM. More privileged to welcome back to the show Michael Rubin. He is the resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, senior lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School, talks to our troops, teaches them. For my money, the best expert on foreign policy in the Middle East I've ever had the privilege of knowing. Glad to welcome him back. Have a lot to do with him. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Pretty good, Seth. Thanks for your generous instructions.
I mean it all. I mean it all very sincerely. And I could spend a long time going over your CV, your resume, but I think we'll just let the analysis speak for itself. Michael, I want to do a lot with you from Iran to Iraq. But first, Syria's in the news again. And I think I'd like to start there with you, if that's okay. How do you see the situation in Syria right now? How do you think this administration has played it? And where do you think we're going?
Well, the administration, throughout all the Arab Spring uprisings and the civil wars, has been like a gambler that only wants to place his bets after he sees what everyone else's cards are. And so we tend to get involved. We tend to miss our windows of opportunity to actually shape the developments. Now, Syria is difficult. If Obama is giving new meaning to leading from behind, because he seems to be deferring all responsibility to the Senate, which, as on the Iran sanctions, is saying enough is enough. That said, there are real reasons to be concerned in Syria. Syria is not Libya. You have, as in Libya, actually the chemical weapons problem in Syria. Thankfully, Gaddafi didn't use them. But you also have a Russian naval base in Syria, and that should be raising a lot of concern.
Michael, it's leading from behind, to be sure. But leading up to now, there has been, I think, either negligence or something far more willful with regard to Syria based on either ideology or stupidity. I look at Syria and I think two things. Many of us, you, me, a lot of us knew who Assad was, knew who his father was, have seen the depredations he has waged in the region and on his own people. And yet our Secretary of State could a year ago call him a reformer. This is the same country, of course, where President Bush sent a message by taking our U.S. ambassador out of that country. This president, Barack Obama, sent a message to Syria by giving them the credibility of our ambassador back.
Oh, I agree with you. I think ultimately the problem is Washington navel-gazing.
Okay.
The reason why the Obama administration, even before Obama was elected, people like Senator Kerry, Senator Specter, and Nancy Pelosi had made Bashar al-Assad and outreach to Bashar al-Assad such a pillar of their foreign policy was simply because they saw everything through the lens of George Bush. Whatever George Bush did, they considered to be 100% wrong, mm-hmm. without actually considering that the problem wasn't in the White House. It was actually with the rogue leader that George Bush was rightfully confronting.
Okay, all right. Do you see Assad going, leaving power?
I don't think he's going to leave power by choice. Mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, the worst-case scenario might be leaving Syria like Iraq after 1991, where Saddam Hussein was weakened. He had faced this huge uprising but managed to put it down, and was really a font of instability for 12 years after that, leading up to the Operation Iraqi Freedom. The other problem is, I think that President Obama is really strategically short-sighted. Say what you will about how we got into the Iraq conflict, but we have to live in the here and now, and geopolitics is important. Syria was Iran's only ally, and it was isolated. If Syria fell, Hezbollah would wither and dry up, unable to be supplied by Iran. So what does President Obama do? He simply unilaterally withdraws from Iraq, hands Iraq to Iran on a silver platter, which means that Iran now has a mechanism to not only supply Syria, but over land to support everything, all of its proxies, all the way to the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay. Michael Rubin is whom we're speaking with. He's senior, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and senior lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School. Michael, you read my mind on where we were going, which is to Iraq. I want to spend some time with you on that. It seems to be the forgotten country now, even though it was the country that you couldn't help but read about for about 10 years. Joel Brinkley, who has his own reputation, pretty good amongst the elite or the intellectual elite, he wrote this in the Politico recently. He wrote, quote, after Bush negotiated an end to the U.S. military presence in Iraq near the end of his term, his advisors and generals began warning of three large potential problems: growing Iranian influence in Iraq, increasing sectarian violence, and the possibility that al-Qaeda in Iraq will grow in capacity. Joel Brinkley goes on to say, interviewing several former officials and experts, they acknowledge most, if not all, of that has now happened. Can you address that for a moment? It didn't have to, Michael. It didn't have to.
Well, I mean, that's the point. I agree with you there. It is absolutely a mistake and a common mistake of the foreign policy establishment to assume that because Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is Shiite and the majority of the Iraqi population is Shiite, that necessarily they were preordained to be an Iranian proxy. There's other countries out there which are Shiite. For example, Azerbaijan, first and foremost, right on Iran's border, which is actually, Azerbaijan is an ally of the United States and of Israel, not of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, and just looking historically at Iraq, if I may, for a second,
please.
During the Iran-Iraq war, it wasn't the favorite sons of Saddam Hussein and Tikrit that were on the front line fighting Iran. It was mostly the Iraqi Shiite conscripts who simply did not, I mean, they may have been co-religionists with Iran, but Arabs don't like Persians, period. Now, the reason why Iran has such a predominant influence now is because we have removed the ability of the Iraqi government to play the Americans and the Iranians off each other to maintain an independent space. We had our troops for the last couple years in Iraq, not in the cities, but basically in operating bases in the countryside, out of sight, out of mind. But that was enough. That was tripwire enough to prevent the Iranians from running roughshod over Iraq, because whenever they would try to pressure the Iraqi prime minister, he would say, I'd love to help you, but I can't with the Americans here. President Obama removed Nouri al-Maliki's ability to say that,
mm-hmm.
So the Iranians really do dominate. They will impose through force of arms what isn't necessarily in people's hearts and minds there, and we allow them to do it.
Now, what most people will read from the mainstream media, Michael, is that we didn't have a choice in getting our troops out. We didn't have a choice because we couldn't get the appropriate negotiations concluded with the Iraqis, with the Iraqi government, to provide enough safety to our troops.
Iraq. I mean, this is just wrong on two counts.
Yep.
First of all, the way Iraqis negotiate, and frankly, the way Middle Easterners negotiate, is that they let the clock count down to the end, then they go into a smoke-filled room. They isolate themselves in there for two or three days, smoking cigars if no foreign press is around, drinking whiskey, and hash out an agreement. So Obama walked out even before the negotiations really started to begin. Now, this issue about the immunity is important, but this is where Obama basically is being dishonest. Nouri al-Maliki had no problem with American troop immunity. However, the State Department said, well, what we really need to do is have the Iraqi parliament vote on it. And that opened up a populist can of worms.
Mm-hmm.
I find it extremely ironic that the State Department is telling the Iraqi parliament how Iraqi law has to be interpreted, rather than allowing the prime minister simply to do what he thinks needs to be done, and you wouldn't have had any problems with it.
It's not astounding when you sit back and realize that this is a president that likes to tell our allies what to do and appease our enemies at the same time, and those allies' enemies. When we come back, Michael, I'd like to talk a little bit about that with you vis-a-vis Iran and vis-a-vis Israel, and maybe some concluding thoughts on Iraq, too. Can you stay with us one more segment?
Yeah, of course.
Be be glad to have you, be honored to have you. We'll be right back with more on the Middle East and this administration with Michael Rubin here on Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Please stay tuned.
Arresting, ear-catching talk from the Bulova Studios of Bill Bennett's Morning in America.
Seth Leibson in for Bill this Friday, March 9, 2012, continuing our conversation with Michael Rubin on the Middle East and foreign policy. If you want to get in on the conversation, you are more than welcome to. The line is the number is 866-680-6464. Michael, before we leave Iraq and move on to some of the other countries, I wanted to run this thought by you. In the middle of the Iraq war, a lot of criticism, obviously, and that understates it by 90%. But some of us were saying, yeah, but what if it works? Yeah, but it could work. And what if it does? What it could mean for the entire Middle East, what it could mean for the West, what it could show the rest of the Arab world. What if it worked? We had a chance. I mean, things looked pretty good in 07 and 08, or at least in 08. Did we blow it? Is it irretrievably blown?
I think it is. And ultimately, for those who would argue that when things were going well, for those who would argue that it's just original sin and we should have just pulled out, there was amazing parallel between the debates that took place under the George W. Bush administration and those that involved Korea under the Harry S. Truman administration. Both were criticized for much the same thing, but today, and Harry S. Truman left office as one of the most unpopular presidents ever after having gotten the Americans involved in the quagmire of Korea. But when we juxtapose North Korea and South Korea, I don't think many people doubt that American involvement in the Korean War was worth it. And Harry S. Truman, according to historians, most of which are overwhelmingly liberal, is considered one of the top five presidents ever now.
Yeah.
This segues into the whole Iran discussion in a number of ways, but there's this false assumption out there that there's always a choice between doing nothing. I mean, this is what Richard Haass said, a war of choice, that either we could get involved in Iraq or the status quo would have just lasted forever.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, under Saddam Hussein, the status quo was collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
President Bush needed to make a choice. The one thing which Saddam Hussein's documents show is that he expected sanctions to collapse, and he was going to reconstitute his program.
Right.
The intelligence was wrong about the status of the program, but it wasn't wrong about Saddam Hussein's ambition.
Right,
when
all the reports confirmed this from Dorflinger on. Dolfler on, yeah, right.
When we look at the Iran situation, again, there's a false choice. Either we can enjoy you can't call them low anymore, but the gas prices we have now, or you can go into Iraq, have some sort of military action and risk everything. But the fact of the matter is, and Supreme Leader Khamenei will be the first to say this, as he has done in his recent speeches, the status quo is no longer tenable.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, leaders need to make choices in such situations.
Because it's so important and rich, I'm going to maybe save Iran and Israel for the next segment, which is a long segment. We only have a minute and a half or so left at this one. So let me just close out Iraq with you, if I could, on this short segment with the time of it. We were doing well 07-08 in Iraq. We were turning it around. Things seemed to be progressing on an upward trajectory. We had negotiated a status of forces agreement with them. The warnings came to us at the highest levels that if we blew it, sectarian violence, Iranian influence, and a resurgent Al-Qaeda in Iraq would take place. President Obama did a full withdrawal. seems to have neglected any analysis in that withdrawal of those possibilities. Those possibilities have come to become reality now. And he did this not just against the advice of previous administration's advisors, but his own generals. No?
Exactly. But let me just draw out one further point. President Obama relied on some advice he got that said, we can still control things in Iraq, we can still counter terrorism by just having an over-the-horizon capability. We will have troops in Kuwait, we can have predators from the Persian Gulf, perhaps troops in Turkey, what have you. But what the Iraqi situation shows is that logic falls flat. Without having boots on the ground, you don't have the access to actionable intelligence that you would need to do effective counterterrorism. You need to know where the terrorists will be 2 hours from now, not where they were 2 hours ago. What's frustrating is when we talk about Afghanistan, President Obama is now relying on the same logic, that we can just rely maybe on special operations or on over-the-horizon threat, over-the-horizon capability, not realizing that you actually need boots on the ground in order to gain the actionable intelligence to keep Pandora's box closed.
Perfect. We'll be right back with more from Michael Rubin.
Arresting, ear-catching talk from the Boulevard Studios of Bill Bennett's Morning in America.
It is Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Seth Leibson in for Bill Bennett today, rejoined by Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, senior lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School, and many, many other credentials. Michael, I'd like to, if I could, move a little bit to Iran and then Israel and then maybe both at the same time. What is this? Where to start here? Iran has plagued the United States for 33 years. My position here is it's been at war with us for 33 years now, and
indeed,
we have not joined that war. Accurate assessment: we have not joined it. And if so, are we going to? And how should we?
Well, the Iranians always quip that they play chess while the Americans play checkers. I don't think they ever expected that the Obama administration would sit there and simply play solitaire, completely uncognizant of what the Iranians were doing and what our adversary strategy was. Now, when it comes to our strategy against Iran, to be fair, we haven't had a coherent strategy against Iran for administrations, both Republican and
sure.
Democratic.
Agreed. I agree.
Okay. Now, if we are going to have diplomacy, and this is what the Obama administration says it wants, then they need to set the right circumstances. We need to negotiate from a position where we have an advantage. I can only think of twice in Iranian history where the Iranians have staked out a position as forceful as they have on their nuclear program and stepped back from that position. The first was with the American hostages, that they swore that they simply would never release until we had fulfilled a litany of demands. But then in 1981, they released them, falling short of those demands. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of Carter administration aides said that the reason why the Iranians released those hostages was simply because of the persistence of Carter administration diplomacy. The late, great Peter Rodman, however, had what I think is a really seminal article in 1981. He was a Kissinger aide, and most recently before his death, he was an assistant secretary of defense in the Bush administration. Uh-huh. He said, look, the reason why Iran released the hostages was not because of Carter administration diplomacy. It was because Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, and so the cost of holding those hostages had simply become too great to bear. The second time was when Iran said that they were going to pursue the Iran-Iraq war until they had Baghdad and Saddam Hussein was in the gallows. Mm-hmm. But in 1988, Khomeini, the revolutionary leader in Iran, got on the radio and said, it's like drinking a chalice of poison, but I'm going to go for a ceasefire, because simply put, the cost to Iran was too great to bear. Mm-hmm. The question for Obama is, how are we going to make the cost to Iran too great to bear?
My concern, what keeps me up at night when I think about that cost, Michael, is sanctions, this issue of sanctions. Now, there's a lot to go through before we even get to how hard the sanctions are that we want to impose further. So there's a lot that I think we've missed. There are a lot of missteps we've taken on the way to where we are today, and I'll get back to those. But let's start with sanctions and what keeps me up at night. Scholar I respect told me sanctions have never worked with an enemy regime. Never worked with an enemy regime. Your assessment?
I don't think sanctions alone will work, and simply treating them as something which alone can work is a mistake. Any comprehensive strategy, as any military officer will say, has a diplomatic, an informational, a military, and an economic component, and doing them in conjunction is what amplifies each. Sanctions are part of a strategy, but I think we also need a military strategy. That doesn't mean bombing. That means convincing the Iranians that unless they give up without a shot being fired, they're going to pay too great a price for their regime to bear.
Okay, and that's what takes me to this point, which is convincing Iran of our position of strength. It seems to me we have engaged in, as you say, several administrations fumbling this, but in the past 3 years, that fumbling has been taken to a fairly well. We start by saying we want to negotiate with them without precondition, even though we had been negotiating with them. We take that up a notch. We do such small yet large things as reach out to them by offering our embassies to them for 4th of July celebrations. We say Iran is not a threat. We publicly state Iran is not a threat. And then comes something quite interesting, middle of 2009. Comes an organic revolution on the streets of Iran that looks pro-democratic, that looks pro-American, looks pro-Obama, actually. Looks like one of those rare occurrences that only happens once in a lifetime, if that. And when we had a moment to just blow a little life into that, we stood back and we said, we're not going to meddle, which was, in fact, to me, a siding with the malocracy. Your take.
I would agree with you. When Obama actually said, just going back to your list, that we will negotiate without preconditions, he actually undermined diplomacy and the chance for diplomatic success, because what he did was unilaterally reversed 3 unanimous or near unanimous Security Council resolutions which had forbidden Iran from enriching uranium. So when he does that, Iran has no incentive to ever again trust what the United Nations says. It will believe that if there's no defiance, their messiah, Obama, will simply come to their rescue. Now, just last week, Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, issued a statement on his website, part of which said, actions speak louder than words. Unfortunately, President Obama never actually listens to what the Iranian leadership says, because in certain cases, they couldn't be more transparent.
And yet he tells them the kinds of things that would give them every reason to believe that we have not joined the war, that we are not serious. I recall greeting
message,
to the Iranians.
And that's coming up again, the anniversary of that,
right,
just in a week or two.
His first one in 2009 was abominable. It was abominable because he put on the same plane the leadership of Iran and the citizens of Iran who live under a thumbscrew.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we've often given Persian New Year's greetings, but we've always differentiated between reaching out to the Iranian people and legitimizing the regime, the Islamic Republic. If you go back to the Axis of Evil speech, George Bush, on one hand, condemned the Islamic Republic, but on the other hand, he also reached out to the Iranian people in that speech. But the real problem, I think, right now is President Obama and this discussion of red lines. Hearing the discussion of red lines, I'm not sure President Obama understands basically the way this idea of drawing a red line at nuclear weapons rather than nuclear weapons capability,
right,
is interpreted throughout the region.
Right.
I mean, basically, you know, a nuclear weapons capability is the ability to assemble, I mean, to have the technology and to assemble a bomb should you need one, but not to make a but you haven't yet made the decision to actually put that bomb together.
Right.
This is the situation of what, for example, Japan is in. And Obama is willing, with a wink and a nod, to say, okay, you can go as far as Japan did. What he forgets, however, is that Japan and Iran aren't the same thing. We can't have all this moral equivalence or cultural equivalence which permeates the White House. They have very different ideologies. The fact of the matter is, if you have a nuclear weapons capability like Japan, you could, in theory, put together a bomb in a week or less. Mm-hmm. When Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel comes and says, no, the red line has to be nuclear weapons capability, and he's dismissed by President Obama, what President Obama is signaling is we're just going to let Iran get nuclear weapons, because when that decision is made, we're not going to know about it until that nuclear weapon is tested. So it's not just the Israelis who are in shock. It's the Saudis, it's the Pakistanis, it's everyone who's surrounding Iran. Because what President Obama has in effect done is said, we're going to go with containment. We're not going to go with this other red line.
We're talking with Michael Rubin. All right, you got us to Israel. Let's go to Israel. Last Sunday, President Obama said, there should not be a shred of doubt. When the chips are down, I have Israel's back. I heard that quote, Michael. You know as well as I do that when you put a line like that in a speech, it's gone through maybe, I don't know, how many eyes have had to approve that line? 500? I don't know.
Exactly.
You know how that goes in these speech writing camps when you're talking about Israel or foreign policy generally. When the chips are down, I have Israel's back. I haven't seen that in the last 3 years. I think that was another lie.
Well, I think it was, and he more or less reversed it the following day. The fact of the matter is, President Obama has made up any number of excuses why he hasn't even gone to visit Israel. Maybe it was his daughter's parent-teacher conference. Maybe it was because he had a date night in New York. The point is, President Obama has signaled time and time again that he couldn't care less about Israel and Netanyahu. One thing that's not in the press. I mean, this is ironic. The only country which President Obama is actively seeking regime change is Israel, the region's only democracy. Every time Ehud Barak, Israel's defense minister, comes to Washington, he has had a closed-door meeting, often off the books without press, with President Obama, in which they talk about how great it would be if Bibi Netanyahu was no longer prime minister. All Bibi Netanyahu has to do is read the books by people like Dennis Ross, Obama's former advisor, to understand the antipathy with which they personally hold him. Now, the irony here and the irony of Obama's speech is Obama has dedicated his whole presidency to reversing the legacy of Ronald Reagan, and yet when push comes to shove, now Obama wants to be an actor giving an Oscar-winning performance. It's just he's not going to get away with it.
You said something chilling. I'd never thought of it that way before, Michael. The only regime in the Middle East President Obama wants to change is Israel. I might say he did his work on Egypt, too, another ally country, by calling for Mubarak to step down. I would say the two allies.
After pretty much Mubarak had already more or less stepped down.
Yeah, I think he was the final straw on that camel's back.
Yeah.
But that is a chilling point. That is a chilling point. Well, I'd like to have you back, Michael, and talk more about other allies we have threatened by our words and by our actions and by our poor diplomacy, and enemies we have strengthened. We're out of time for this morning, but I really appreciate all your hard and fine work, and you're spending some of your morning with us. Will you come back soon?
Yeah, anytime.
Thank you. Michael Rubin, American Enterprise Institute, Senior Lecturer, Naval Postgraduate School. Great resource, great international resource, and resource to our troops, whom he teaches all the time. And they're better for it, as we're better for them. When we come back, we'll take final calls. We have one line open, 866-680-6464. Politics, foreign policy, anything you like. And a closing thought from Ronald Reagan, as we like to do on Fridays. Stay tuned.
From the Bulova Studios, it's Morning in America.
It is Morning in America. There's no doubt about that. I'm looking out at the sunrise over Camelback Mountain. Got Dolly Parton here. I'm going to end the show with Reagan and Dolly Parton. It's a great country. It's great to be in this country. Gratefulness, it's an important virtue. great to be in this. Just great to be an American. Great to be with you this morning. And really thank you for spending some of your time with us. Ken is in Kensington, Maryland. Good morning, Ken.
Well, good morning. And I wanted to just commend you on this remarkable show that you we've just listened to with Michael Rubin. Michael is a good friend of mine, and he's one of the best analysts on Iran that I know. You know, I've been the head of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran for the past 15 years, and we work with the pro-freedom movement inside Iran. And what Michael said was so true. We had a terrific opportunity in June of 2009 when there were 3 million people in the streets all across Iran calling for freedom and calling on the United States to help them. And what did Obama did? He stayed silent. I think that the appeasement policies that Obama and people like Chris Van Hollen in Maryland, who is Nancy Pelosi's right-hand man, these appeasement policies are leading us to a war we do not need and that we can actually avoid.
Let me thank you for your comments and your work, Ken, if I might, first of all. Second of all, let me just take it a little step further and see if you agree. I don't think Obama stayed silent during the Iranian possible revolution back to democracy. I read in the New York Times the quotes, "Where's Obama? Where's America?" He said one thing that resonated a lot around the world and resonated with the mollocracy as well as the protesters on the streets. He said, "We will not meddle." Now, that's more than neutrality, quite frankly, when one side has nothing but sneakers and the other side has guns. That's taking a side.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. For 3 weeks, he said nothing. And then finally, when he did open his mouth, that's what he said. And that was the kiss of death. That was the end of it. And essentially, that endorsement of the Mullah regime after staying silent for 3 weeks sealed the fate of the pro-freedom movement in June of 2009. I think it's a travesty. I think it's a betrayal of all the values that we hold dear in this country. And we didn't have to go. We don't have to go into Iran with boots on the ground. Nobody that I know is suggesting that.
Agreed.
And I have never suggested that. But we can help, and I believe we must help the people of Iran if we want to prevent a war that is otherwise inevitable.
Yeah, my concern, Ken, my concern is that we had that moment. It's such a rare, the kind of moment that is so rare, it happens maybe once in a lifetime if you're lucky, and we blew it, and they're now in jail or dead. Right. That's my fear. That's my concern. And that what could have been done at a community organizing level, for goodness sakes, is now going to come down to a hot war level. That's my concern. Didn't have to be.
It did not have to be, and that's one of the reasons I'm running for Congress here in Maryland against Chris Van Hollen. This is the man whose appeasement policies are bringing us this war that we do not need and that we can prevent. There are so many things that we can do, tools of diplomacy that we can use that we're not using, helping the pro-freedom movement through secure communications. I mean, there's lots of stuff that we know how to do that we're simply refusing to do. I've been on the ground in northern Iraq, for example, with the Kurdish opposition.
Ken, can I? We got to close out. Will you call me next week? Can we do this next week? I'm going to ask you to hold, and we're going to get your information. I'm going to have you on as a guest next week. This is wonderful that you came to us organically this way. We'll have you next week. We got to close, as we normally do, with some other words of freedom from a better president.
Individual liberty, representative government, and the rule of law under God. I've often wondered about the shyness of some of us in the West about standing for these ideals that have done so much to ease the plight of man and the hardships of our imperfect world. This reluctance to use those vast resources at our command reminds me of the elderly lady whose home was bombed in the Blitz. As the rescuers moved about, they found a bottle of brandy she'd stored behind the staircase, which was all that was left standing. And since she was barely conscious, one of the workers pulled the cork to give her a taste of it. She came around immediately and said, "Here, there, now put it back. That's for emergencies." Well, the emergency is upon us. Let us be shy no longer. Let us go to our strength. Let us offer hope. Let us tell the world that a new age is not only possible, but probable. During the dark days of the Second World War, when this island was incandescent with courage, Winston Churchill exclaimed about Britain's adversaries, "What kind of a people do they think we are?" Well, Britain's adversaries found out what extraordinary people the British are. But all the democracies paid a terrible price for allowing the dictators to underestimate us. We dare not make that mistake again. So let us ask ourselves, what kind of people do we think we are? And let us answer, free people, worthy of freedom, and determined not only to remain so, but to help others gain their freedom as well.